Hi, and welcome to the Friday Coffee Meetup Podcast for Friday, June 5th, 2020. On today's episode, we'll hear from Chris Thayer, CEO of Motive Space Systems, on this week's virtual meetup about moving the decimal point for new space. The Friday Coffee Meetup Podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory, a Pasadena-based marketing and advertising agency that specializes helping healthcare, consumer goods, clean tech, and aerospace companies achieve rapid sustainable growth. Echo Factory CEO Mike Schaefer is a co-founder and organizer of Friday Coffee Meetup. If you're interested in how Echo Factory can help your company achieve rapid sustainable growth, you can learn more at echo-factory.com. Every week, the Friday Coffee Meetup brings together innovators, startups, investors, tech companies, and entrepreneurs at the cross-campus co-working space in Pasadena. You can learn more about upcoming meetups and how you can attend in person at FridayCoffeeMeetup.com. Now, here's Chris with this week's presentation.
With that, I am so excited to introduce to you Chris Thayer of Motive Space Systems. He's going to talk to us about moving the decimal point for new space. Space exploration is a very costly business, and he's going to talk to us about navigating NASA contracts, as well as commercializing advanced space robotics. The company's work includes robotic systems for NASA JPL's Mars 2020 mission, and as well has recently launched an X-Link space-rated modular robotic arm system. With that, I'm very pleased to open it up to Chris Thayer. Welcome, Chris.
Hey there, thank you. Share my screen here. Okay, can you guys see that?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So thanks for the introduction. Good morning, everybody. New or commercial space is an area where you see bold ideas that sometimes have never been tried before. And these ideas can come with risks to both the investor side and also the employees and people who put in a lot of sweat equity into the visions and the dreams of those companies. And often using methods or products from the past, these ideas can't be realized. But if we can find new ideas or perhaps new approaches, some of these visions can be realized. We set out to make a company that can enable these new space ideas, if you will, from things like in-space manufacturing, where we build structures that were unthinkable in the past in terms of scale or scope, to servicing, repairing some assets that may already be up there that it's difficult to replace those, all the way to protecting current assets susceptible to orbital debris or things like that. And then obviously utilizing space resources for sustained human presence or any of those kind of activities and just general space exploration, which I think everyone's pretty familiar with on that concept. So I'm Chris Thayer. Was already stated, I'm president, CEO, and a co-founder of Motive Space Systems. We always kind of looked at ourselves like a pickaxe and shovel company, if you will, from the gold rush days, kind of enabling all these new missions with advanced robotics. I have a background in technical and organizational leadership and space flight robotics. I've also, dabbled in race cars and underwater robotics and a number of different, aircraft applications. And I'd like to share with you a little bit about who we are, what we're doing and where we see robotics going in the future. So a bit about Motive Space Systems. We founded Motive Space Systems back in 2014 with a vision for doing some innovative things in both the space side and also in ground robotics, which may not be obvious in our company name. We saw some gaps in the market and we thought we could fill those gaps with some of our knowledge and expertise. And the image that you see here is JPL's 2020 Mars rover Perseverance, for which we're providing a number of critical hardware elements. This is really a great example for us of collaborative project with NASA where we thought we could really add some value. So when we first set out, we knew we had to build a great team because nothing happens without a great team on board. Our first step in building that team was finding people with a breadth of experience encompassing most of the major robotics developments in the space sector over the past 20 years, from things like the Mars rovers of Spirit and Opportunity, Curiosity lander, to landers of Phoenix and InSight, but servicing missions from both DARPA and Goddard, and all sorts of advanced ground robots like Valkyrie and Robonaut and RoboSimian. We assembled a team with kind of a deep experience and also a vision for what where we wanted to go. But of course, you know, building the team is never over. It's not like we finished on the first day. So we keep adding talent to the pool, both in breadth and depth, to try to, you know, augment and keep growing as things change. Let's see. So this is kind of interesting. We had a very specific approach to how we wanted to build the company out. One of those things was this building block approach. And, you know, being a small business, you have to make sure that every step you take is kind of an affirmative step, one that you want to take and one that builds towards the future. And that's kind of like amassing Legos into, you know, assemble new capabilities and new things and new products. So we try to ensure that if we go and compete for a program or we're developing a new product, it's leveraging both our core competencies and it also leads to a vision. So they're not kind of terminal or dead end roads. We use our IRAD, internal research and development funding, for key development efforts. We use SBIR funding, so small business innovative research. We try to leverage those funding sources from the government, but we do so in a way that builds products we need for our portfolio, and that's proven to be very, very valuable. And we also use technology licensing from places like Caltech or, you know, NASA. And those can be a springboard for growth areas as well. So anyway, that's been a great path for us in terms of building out capability. These are just some of the some examples of some recent flight deliverable projects that we've done that have kind of made an impact on us. So you've got the Mars 2020 rover. We did the robotic arm for that, obviously. It's up in the upper left-hand corner there. This was actually a pretty significant challenge. We had to increase the payload capacity from the Curiosity rover, which most people know is up on Mars right now. We had to increase that payload capacity by 50% without significant relief in terms of mass or size of the robotic system. So we had to really stretch. We had to make much more capable actuation systems. We had forced torque sensing, a number of different things. And that was a real challenge, but the team got a lot of satisfaction out of doing that. Additionally, you know, that forced torque sensor is the first one that's gonna go up. And for roboticists, they understand that means you can basically tell what the arm is touching. Without a forced torque sensor or without force sensing in an arm, you really can't tell if you're making contact with the ground or what kind of loads are being imparted into the system. So that's a huge enabling thing. It's small, but it's a huge thing. MassCam Z on the lower left-hand corner. That's also going up on the 2020 rover, and you'll see that on the mast, if you will, of the rover. That'll be the first ever stereoscopic zoom capability on another planet. So that'll be great to see that coming back. And we did that with the Mielan Space Science Systems. The cryogenic filter wheel in the center, which admittedly is not an obvious robotics fit, is an application which we employed kind of a novel approach to control for thermal and power management, which actually translated into the robotic side as well. So sometimes it's about, you know, exploring these different paths and then reinfusing what you learn in those paths into other products. And that's something we certainly have done on this example, but I'll talk a little bit more about that later in terms of other things we've done. And on the right is the Restore L satellite servicing program at Goddard, for which we've been developing kind of next generation state-of-the-art drive electronics for, which will really enable a number of different elements for that mission. So all kind of very exciting things, and they all feed into each other. In terms of our SBIR strategy, this is another good story, I think, where we set out to have a SBIR for the icy worlds. So the icy moons around Jupiter and Saturn, they are very, very cold, and there's not a lot of power there. So it's helpful if you can have electronics that can operate at very cold temperatures. In this case, we set out to make a motor controller that could operate at -185°C. And we succeeded in that SBIR, but we were always mindful that for a lot of customers, a lot of people that are doing space and orbital missions, they don't need that capability. So we tried to make sure that we had parts and design that was flexible so that it didn't have to have all those the same components that it needed for operating down at -185°. So we did that, and we actually created a product out of that. Then that was commercialized, and it's been deployed many times on several missions and applications, and I think that will continue to go on. And we've done this in other areas, but this is a really great example of that. So then the other side is another example that we do internal product development, where we just have a good idea, we think, and then we start slowly funding that to see if the idea proves out. And then we kind of go and really develop that as a flight product. This is an example of a small motor controller that we then deployed on four missions now. And that was an idea that someone had in the building, and we just thought it was a good one and kept funding it. So let's see here. Use the block. Whoa, sorry. Technical difficulties. But then we also, kind of from very early on, we thought there was something to bringing the flight experience we had in our flight robotic systems into the ground robot as well. What you see here is our RoboMantis robot, which is a modular, reconfigurable robot, and it suits a broad number of applications for use here on Earth. And while it's great for the ground system stuff, and it's kind of it's a cool robot, I think it actually turned out to be important on the space side, and we'll talk about that in a second. So let's see here. With that, you know, we have kind of end-to-end solutions for robotics for a variety of applications, and are actively working efforts, you know, for the moon, Mars, and things like the icy worlds I mentioned, comet applications, servicing construction, and then just generically, human missions and human exploration. But again, as we build those building blocks up, we've been able to leverage those chunks all the time. As we do them, we say, well, we're going to reuse this later. We're going to reuse this design later. Let's make sure we have flexibility to do that. And that lowers the NRE and reduced schedule for those things going forward. And whether that's a commercial or a government mission, saving money is usually well received. So that's something we try to do, and it also reduces schedule and risk to those missions as well. So the bespoke one-off robotic systems like the one you see here, that is the robotic arm being installed on the Perseverance rover. Those always have a place in these science applications. And, you know, we're obviously very proud to keep doing them and running with that. But to enable the broader ecosystem vision for the space economy, we have to adapt to a new way of doing things as well. That's more accessible and more productized. And now we can offer both of those paths going forward. So here we have our nice little story of our custom space robotics encapsulated in that picture, whether that's drive electronics or sensing or perception or whatever. And then we also have our ground robotics products. And, you know, like I said earlier, we initially thought, well, let's bring our flight robotics into the ground robotics side. And then at some point we realized, well, actually, what if we reverse that flow and started taking the lessons we're learning on the ground robotics side and flow that back into the flight systems? And what could that do? Could that change things? So we really wanted to build a system that could be a kind of a ubiquitous robotics presence, enable that in orbit. But to do that, you have to bring the cost down. You have to make things easy. So we wanted to build a modular reconfigurable system, which we had on the ground side, adaptable architecture, really to be able to suit a broad number of missions, kind of that 80-20 rule. We wanted to build a system that really could encapsulate a vast majority of the missions that were out there. And obviously, cost is a big deal. So if you have startups that are trying to, they've got that dream, they want to go out, they want to get rid of orbital debris, or they want to be a space tug, or they want to do a number of different things, build things on orbit. It usually can't be at those kind of flagship NASA level budgets. So you have to make it less expensive, easier to integrate. The delivery times need to be brought way down. And also we need to, this is something that's not obvious if you're not inside, you know, the game. The accommodations for the spacecraft, you need to make sure that you have a minimal footprint so you don't have to change your spacecraft because you're putting a robotic arm on there. We try to think that we want, a lot of times right now, you say, I have got a robotic mission or a robot mission. What you want to have is just missions that have robots, if that makes sense. So it's not the mission's purpose. It's just another thing, another tool that's there for use everywhere. So that brings us to X-Link. X-Link is Motive's modular robotic manipulation system for space. Here you see an example of X-Link grappling a small satellite and preparing to berth it to its host spacecraft. This is a good example of kind of what we can do and what we hope to do with the X-Link product. So you may notice that this looks very similar to our ground robots, and that's intentional, like RoboMantis. And so we have a design here that's it's a modular system, so we can actually reconfigure that into multiple different instantiations. And all the control electronics are embedded in the arm itself. So the attributes of modularity, scalability, flexibility allow the system to be affordably deployed in everything from a research lab all the way through various Earth orbits to the moon and even to Mars. So we can really take this system and at those various price points for researchers all the way through to long duration life in space, we can actually meet those needs. So that's kind of a game changer. And obviously trying to reduce that cost so everyone can participate. And really that's the goal, is to enable everyone to be able to put robots where they need them in space. Here you see just a quick graphic showing three example configurations of X-Link ranging from 1 to 3 meters in length. All of these are basically the way that you look at these right now, they're actually testable in Earth's gravity, which is a huge advantage, especially when you talk about, you know, 2 and 3 meter lengths for arms. That's a game changer as well. A lot of arms that you'll see in space currently, those things were not testable on Earth without offloading or support. So that's something that really allows you to do rapid integration and test and validate what you're doing in your operations. And that's something that we think is also helps with the speed to market. We kind of assemble these things like they're Lego pieces, including the what's not shown here, but including perception systems, the computation control systems, and we can really configure and tailor this to a user's specific needs. So our first scheduled launch of X-Link is actually scheduled to happen on Arkonaut 1. And this is a mission led by Maiden Space, where they're doing a 3D printed large solar array boom. And these new solar arrays promise to yield significantly more power, 5x what is currently capable on a spacecraft of that size. On our arm, we'll be positioning various printing components and both the printer and printed components up there. So that will be a really kind of a revolutionary demonstration of on-orbit manufacturing and robotics as well. So to wrap things up, I wanted to give a plug for our achievement that both our team and thousands of people around the, you know, the LA Basin have worked on tirelessly for years now, the Perseverance rover for Mars 2020, which is launching in just a few weeks. We're obviously super excited about that. But with the theme of enabling, the robotic arm we designed and built will enable a search for microbial life, as well as being the first link in the chain of bringing samples of Mars back to Earth through its coring and sample collection system. So that's obviously very exciting, and we obviously hope to be involved in that process in the future for those missions as well. So in conclusion, I just want to thank you all for listening to what Motive's up to and a bit of what I see as the future of space robotics. Thanks.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chris. This is fascinating. I had a quick question before we launch into Q&A. So on the solar panels, did you say they're being printed and assembled in space?
So the actual photovoltaic cells are rolled up on a roll. There's boom is the structural part that's being printed out, and that will extend the roll out. That way, typical solar arrays are structurally rigid panels that get folded up, and that's why it's limiting for a small spacecraft. You can't fit large solar arrays on a spacecraft like that. So this is a relatively innovative, it's a very innovative way of deploying a solar array.
Okay, fantastic. Our first question, how different are X-Link and ground robotics?
So that's a great question. And that was one of the first things that, you know, in that aha moment where we started looking at this, we said, well, wait a second. We looked at that and we said, wait, that's exactly what we need. What do we need to change to make that flight worthy? And so at the end of the day, obviously there are a number of things that are constrain you in space in terms of both computation and then materials and processing. But if you were to tear most of these things apart, they look fairly similar. And that's a bit of a cheat on our side because we come from building space stuff. So then when we build ground stuff, it looks similar to our space stuff. So, primarily you're talking about different materials, sometimes different sensing that you have to put in the actuators. And then obviously from a software and computer side, that's where things get real dicey because you don't have the same computational power that everyone's desktop has right now. It's hard to replicate that on orbit in an affordable manner. So that's where things get more complicated, and you have to be very efficient in those areas.
On the space customizable robotics, what are the services those robotics normally provide, and who are your main targets for that?
So on the X-Link product line, we're really the initial customer base that we're targeting is more of a new space audience. Most of the NASA missions are fairly bespoke or boutique kind of solutions for very specific cases. And a lot of times when we're talking to new customers that are trying to go out and build a business case for a mission or for a service that they're going to provide, they need flexibility all the way through the development process, because they're still working out typically what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. So as they build that use case up, we need flexibility in the system, which typically doesn't happen on something like a government procurement system, which it takes years to get there. And by the time you see it, it's very well thought out and very well documented. But that flexibility is needed on the new space side. And that's primarily the target now, but we are talking with certain government agencies as well to deploy this system on some of their, let's say, innovative platforms.
And how do you decide which technologies to license that you're going to go with? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that's actually really interesting. I think one of the lessons that I had learned over the years, and especially here, really you have to have almost someone who was embedded in the technology at some point in their career to actually be able to transition it from either an academic or government institution. It's very difficult to just take a cold piece of technology and then integrate it. So we've done that with a number of different products where we were familiar with them in our either in a past life or familiar with the people. And so we had an easier path to transition that technology, because usually it doesn't come with a bow on top of it all ready to unwrap and use. You have to do some digging and you have to invest a significant amount of time and effort into it. So you have to know that there's value there. And you can't just go, oh, that looks neat, I'm sure I can use that somehow. You have to really have an understanding. Otherwise, you can waste a significant amount of time. But like I said, with our building block approach, we like to make sure that when we see something that we want to integrate, it has not only use for today, but use for tomorrow and how we would build that into a product line or really augment a whole suite of products.
And in that product process, you know, to fund that, how did you finance your company's launch?
So we actually were internally funded, and we didn't take any external like VC money or angel money. We were very fortunate to be able to do that. And we were profitable from the first month we were in business. So it's a unique situation. I'm fully aware of that. But we've been pretty happy with our ability to do that.
That's fantastic. Some of the robots you showed at the beginning of the talk had very humanoid forms. Could you be able to elaborate on your thoughts on form and function?
Let's see. So, yes, some of the things that you were seeing were from people who had worked at Johnson Space Center. And that included Robonaut and Valkyrie. Two humanoid form factor robots. Those are obviously very interesting, primarily because if you're going to do things in a human environment, that environment's designed for, shocker, humans. And so if you can develop a robot that can interact with the world much the same that a human does, then that's advantageous. The problem being is humans are really amazing, honestly, in terms of both locomotion and dexterity and how they interact with the world. So it's still a big challenge to make a robot that that can mimic the, you know, the nuances of a human form factor. So you see more things that are more direct, like a rover, like you see on the screen now. That's obviously a very purpose-built robot, and it's built more like a robot for doing robot tasks. So I think there's still ongoing research, and that's an exciting area for sure. But for a while, we're still going to see a lot of the robots that depend on to do tasks look more like a classical robot would look. And eventually, I think that the humanoid factor will all, humanoid form factor in the robots will also catch up. The biggest issue with that is power. A wheeled robot is much more power efficient than a walking robot currently. And so that's really something that is difficult to change that. So.
And next we have a technical-ish question. How do you compensate for angular momentum when manipulating an arm in space?
Ooh, that's a good question. So there's a number of different ways, but typically you have reaction wheels on the spacecraft that that counteract those motions of the robotic arm. But it's a dance that you have to be very careful with, especially on something like a small spacecraft, where the robotic arm and its momentum can actually be a significant percentage of that of the host spacecraft, if you will. So you have to control your rates and exactly what you're doing and when you're moving and how you're moving, so you don't saturate your reaction wheels. And this is a real issue that you have to kind of really take care of and mind that. You can kind of think of momentum as a resource on orbit, and you have to mind that carefully. So.
Okay. And in the beginning of the presentation, you talked about some solutions for space debris removal. Can you talk a little bit about that part of your work?
So there's a myriad of different debris that's especially in low Earth orbit, and it's becoming an ever greater problem. Now, we don't do space debris removal per se, but one of the things that you have to look at is how do you get large, spent second stages that are floating around. There's everything from paint chips floating around at, you know, thousands of miles an hour, all the way to large, very large multimeter sized chunks that are floating around up there. And this constant debris issue is something that's very active in not only the U.S. kind of community, but also globally. And there are a number of companies that are going after this to do debris removal. One of the challenges with that is that, as an example, if the Russians launch a spacecraft and they have a second stage that's sitting up there, that's still considered Russian property. So you cannot go as a U.S. company and go grab that and throw it away. That's a treaty violation. So those are... There's a lot of complexity that goes beyond just the complexity of going up and grabbing something and disposing of it. There's also the complexity of international treaty law that goes along with that. So there are a number of people looking at that, but it's still a very fledgling activity. And to date, no one's really actively, cleaning up the orbits as we speak. So that's something that will... I believe it will have to happen at some point. How it happens and who pays for it, that's a different question.
Okay. And that treaty law, I'm assuming there are groups looking at that and how that's going to evolve as we go forward?
Yeah, there are definitely people looking at that, but I don't know how much activity there is on changing any of that as we speak. But there are definitely passionate people trying to move the needle on that, for sure.
Okay. And is your X-Link arm a candidate for a payload on an upcoming NASA commercial lunar landing missions, robotic or human lander?
So that one is we're actually trying to look at some of those CLPS missions going forward, and we're hopeful we have a candidate for that. Outside of that, one of our other products is going to be on a lunar CLPS mission too for a robotic arm that we're developing that we'll be announcing soon. So we'll also be hopefully going to the moon here shortly. With a robotics system that's going to be very unique, but can't say more than that right now, but it should be great.
Okay. And then how do you design electronics for different application areas like Earth orbit, moon, and Mars, speaking of the moon?
Right. So that's obviously very interesting. One of the things that we try to do, because again, you have to do a lot of validation work on the ground before you're either in orbit or Mars or on the moon. And so to do that, people generally, because flight electronics and flight hardware just in general is so expensive, they end up using hardware that's not the same in early testing. So what we tried to do was make sure we had a design that actually we had everything from commercial grade hardware all the way through flagship, you know, class A, mission hardware that was the same. So you were always testing on the same type of system, the same system essentially. So as you build up from your lab all the way through to flight, all that work is relevant. You're never really breaking the chain of that hardware or that system as you go through that process. The big thing is obviously, you know, the killers are for electronics. You've got your radiation environment, which goes everything from fairly benign environments in certain LEO applications, all the way to basically, you know, almost impossible out in the Jovian moons out there. So you've got this range of radiation as a huge issue, and then you've got also the temperature fluctuations. And sometimes everyone wants to focus on the cold part of it. That's a real thing, but sometimes when we're using arms or we're using electronics, actually getting heat out of them is hard too. So that's really the hard part. And then there's mission duration. So a lot of the missions, CubeSats and the like, they can use, you know, fairly low grade commercial parts because they only have to last for a few days or a few weeks. But if you want to last for 15 years in a radiation environment, you have to basically buy very expensive parts that can work in that have been screened and you can have confidence in. So it's really quite a challenge to build a electronics package that can be affordable at all those different areas, be the same essentially in all those areas, but is adaptable enough to be able to be housed and utilized in all those areas as well.
Great. And then can you talk a little bit more about testing your products to qualify and certify them for space environments? What capabilities do you have to have? What does that look like?
Sure. So a lot of times, just the simple infrastructure things, you need to have a bunch of processes in place. You need to have equipment, clean rooms, things like of that nature. And then as you go through the process, different things require different testing services, but you'll go through thermal testing. You go through maybe thermal vacuum testing where you're putting it into a system, into an environment that's similar to what you would find in space, all the way to if you really have a particular case that needs it, you can have a sun simulator on one side and a cold bank on the other side to see what that thermal gradient is in a thermal vacuum situation. And then you do maybe some static testing where you put loads on things to test their structural capacity. And then all the way through vibration testing where you shake it. The old adage is you don't build spacecraft, you build launch craft, because you build the spacecraft to really survive the loads that are imparted during the launch. It's not so much space once you're in space, the loads actually drop quite a bit. So you test all of those things, and it's a test as you fly as you test mantra. So you go through this process of, you know, you test it as it's going to see its environments, and then you fly it just like you tested it. And then that gives you confidence that the system will work.
Okay. Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about government, what the government-private relationship looks like and where you think it will go in the future, as well as kind of those implications around ownership, how resources are used, and then any things that you learn or discover?
That's a lot. You may have to remind me.
Well, let's start with government. Like, can you discuss the kind of government relationship versus the private relationship? Can you talk about what you think it might be evolving to in the future? How it looks now?
Yeah, I think over the past decade or two, you've seen a definite bent towards having what they call a public-private partnership in a lot of these contracting models. You see that even today with the Artemis HLS system that to get back to the moon, where there's a public-private partnership. And most notably, you saw that in the launch the other day of two astronauts to the ISS on a SpaceX launch vehicle. So there's definitely a much tighter integration between NASA or the DoD and private companies. And I think that will only grow because there's significant value there for both parties. If leveraged properly, I think that's a great thing. And I also see that people in the government, that another shift that's happened is more of a desire to buy products. So as they have a need or a mission or something, whereas maybe 30 years ago it would have been let's start from scratch in a clean sheet of paper, to now it's what's out there, what can the commercial sector give us today, and how do we adapt that for our use, which is a pretty seismic shift, I think, and that makes it more in line with how you interact with a commercial company. So it's those things are becoming more similar rather than more dissimilar.
Okay. And then, you know, as you're working together, the implications around ownership, how resources are used, and then, you know, intellectual property, things that are learned or discovered going forward.
Sure. Honestly, the government's great about intellectual property, and especially if you're a small business, they want to foster as much ownership of the IP that you're generating as possible so you can be successful, leverage that, commercialize that. And so that's, I say that the, one of the, and I might get pilloried for this, but one of the best investors you'll find is the U.S. government. They have belief in you, and they want you to succeed, and they're a great partner for growing your business. And if you play that, play that nicely, and complement that with industrial work and working with private companies, you can really foster some pretty powerful things. So.
Okay, great. We had a lot of questions today, but I'm going to wrap up with one looking towards the future. Are there any advancements in emerging tech that will enable space robotics or travel in new ways that you're looking forward to?
So I think, it takes a long time for this stuff to kind of work its way through the system. A lot of the areas a lot of the areas that we can really start to leverage are in computation, and then the electronic side of things. And then along with that are things like autonomy in the robotics side. There, just as an example, it's a 20-minute delay for COM to Mars. So by the time something's happened, by the time you see it happening, it's already done. So the more you can push autonomy onto systems in space, the more you can do. when we look at things like doing construction on the moon, we'll want to have a vast array of robots doing construction. But you can't have a person managing every robot. But you can, but it becomes pretty onerous. So if you can start to have deployment of autonomous systems that are doing tasks, and then you have that modularity, and you have powerful electronics that, you know, the chip makers are actually developing new products for space, which is exciting. And then companies like ours can leverage those and really build out products that are powerful. So those are areas where I really think there's going to be kind of a transformation, and I see as a cooperation, a cooperative model between robots and humans, especially on places like the moon, where you can't have a human presence all the time doing work, and it really you can put the burden of doing kind of the heavy lifting on the robot, and then have the astronaut up there to make the decisions, really using the strengths of each one. Use the decision-making strength of the astronaut and use the, you know, the dull, dirty, dangerous capability of a robot to be out there and doing that work. So that's kind of what I hope for.
Fantastic. Did this, you know, we're going to kind of conclude Q&A now, but did this bring up any other comments that you want to share, or, you know, is there a way that our community can help support you?
I think we're always looking for, you know, new ideas, and, you know, we're obviously one thing we're always in need of is great roboticists and robotic software engineers. So if there are any of those people listening, you know, contact me. I think that, you know, this is kind of a new kind of age of being able to do this stuff. And I'm excited maybe we'll get to go play on the moon soon. I'm really hopeful for that. And I hope everyone watches the launch coming up here in end of July. So anyway, thank you.
The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory. Learn more about how Echo Factory can help your business achieve rapid, sustainable growth at echo-factory.com, and get all the details about upcoming Friday Coffee Meetup episodes at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.